This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Amnesty International has long campaigned against the death penalty, citing its ultimate, irreversible and unduly harsh nature, which offers no room for rehabilitation or remorse for those sentenced. While the death penalty appears to not be a more effective deterrent to crime than other punishments, it's still widely enforced. Joining me to discuss why the death penalty should be abolished is Shamini Darshini, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. Shamini, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Julian, for having me back again.
Firstly, could you elaborate on Amnesty International's stand against the death penalty?
Amnesty International globally, we have campaigned against the use of the death penalty for about 4 decades. We don't believe that the death penalty is an effective deterrent to any type of crime. And we campaign against it because the chances for mistakes to occur is too high.
How widely is the death penalty practiced around the world?
Throughout the last 4 decades, there have been more and more countries which have been abolishing the death penalty. Last year itself, 4 countries abolished it, which is the highest number of countries to have abolished the death penalty in recent years. So we are seeing the trend amongst countries which are letting the death penalty go.
What are the arguments against the death penalty?
Firstly, since Amnesty International started campaigning on the death penalty, we've seen that the death penalty does not do anything to reduce the crime rate. It does not prevent crimes from happening. For example, the drug scourge, right? So we know that drugs are a problem globally, but we don't see that the death penalty has done anything to deter drugs from entering the market. So that's one example. Another argument is the chances of mistakes happening or the wrong person being executed. No criminal justice system is perfect. So the chances of somebody innocent being executed still exists.
Drug trafficking and drugs in general are one of those things that come up time and time again when it comes to the death penalty, particularly here in our country. Is executing drug offenders a violation of international law?
Yes, it is. International law, in particular the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 6 of the ICCPR says that the death penalty can only be used for intentional killing. So what that means is that premeditated murder, you know, states may use the death penalty. But where we are coming from is that we are saying that the death penalty is not going to stop future murders from happening. Yeah, so the death penalty should be abolished altogether.
What are some findings of Amnesty International's Death Sentences and Executions 2015 report?
What we've seen is that the 54% increase in executions comparatively to 2014 was because of 3 countries, Iran, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, where 89% of all the executions in 2015 came from these 3 countries. And this is excluding China, where for years we have documented thousands of executions happening every year.
When it comes to Malaysia specifically, could you define drug-related offences in this context? I mean, what is considered drug-related? For example, is it true that here in Malaysia you'll be sentenced to death if you're caught with as little as 200 grams of drugs?
Yeah, it depends on what type of drug, and different types of drugs have different weightage of which you can be sentenced to death. And Malaysia has a very low threshold when it comes to the amount of drugs. So even for, let's say, 2 or 3 joints of marijuana might get you the death penalty depending on the purity.
What are the flaws then in this mandatory sentencing for drug-related offences from where you're sitting?
Firstly, it doesn't tackle the subject of, if we're talking about drug trafficking, it doesn't really combat drug trafficking. So what we do see in terms of the 1,042 people who are on death row, we know from official figures that about 60% are there for drug trafficking. But these are drug mules. These are people who have been caught during raids and stuff like that. Yes, there have been sizable amounts of drugs that were seized, but most of these cases are individuals who, you know, were at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong things.
Recent cases involving the death penalty have also surfaced in the media. For instance, Koh Jabing, a Sarawakian on death row in Singapore, had his appeal dismissed just last week and will be hanged for the 2010 murder of a China national, Cao Ruiyin. Mm-hmm. Could you give me some details about that case?
Okay. Koh Jabing was first sentenced to death in 2010. He was sentenced to hang. But what happened subsequently is Jabing appealed the year after that. In 2011, he appealed, but the appeal was rejected. In 2013, Singapore amended its mandatory death penalty laws. And subsequently, Jabing had reappealed. Yeah, so Singapore, instead of what it did was it allowed judges to not impose the mandatory death penalty, but instead to introduce life imprisonment together with caning. So after this law was changed, Jabing reappealed, and the appeal was successful. So he received life and 24 strokes of the cane. But what happened was in 2015, this decision was overturned. Yeah, it was overturned, and he once again received death. So this was early last year. And then later last year, in November, his lawyer filed an emergency motion and to stop the execution, his execution, 2 days before it was scheduled. And the motion was successful. And then what happened is that, as you mentioned, a few days ago, the death sentence was reimposed. So Jabing now is at risk of being executed at any time.
Is that it then, in terms of the legal avenues that he could explore to commute his death sentence to life in prison?
According to the Singapore panel of judges, yes. Yeah.
And where does Amnesty stand on this case?
We are currently running a campaign on our website asking that the death sentence be reversed. Jabing, in one of the very few interviews he gave, you know, it was a conversation actually that was picked up by the media. He was telling his sister, Jumai, you know, just accept it. Just accept it. But what we're saying is, we are not on behalf of Jabing and his family. So we are running a campaign to have the Singapore president hear his appeal for clemency and to commute his sentence from death sentence into life imprisonment. So we're still running that campaign.
I'm speaking today with Shamini Darshni, Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia, and we're discussing the death penalty and why Amnesty International takes the position that it should be abolished. And we've been kind of talking about drug offences. We've been talking about a situation in Singapore. But up next, we bring things a little bit closer to home. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Shamini Darshni, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. And today we're discussing the death penalty. Now, earlier we talked about the case of Koh Jabing, a Sarawakian man in Singapore. Mm. But Malaysia also recently executed three men for murder in what Amnesty has called a secretive hanging, as the men's families were given only 2 days' notice. Is this a common practice?
We're not sure what the common practice is because the authorities don't actually tell us. That's why we call it a secretive hanging. Any use of the death penalty anywhere in the world should be a transparent process, right? Because you want to talk, you want to have conversations like this where you're talking about the death penalty and trying to see whether it's really effective in reducing crime or preventing criminals from further action. In this particular case, there were the three executions that happened on the 25th of March of Guna, Sasi, and Ramesh. What happened was the family of Guna only received the letter informing of the execution 2 days before, on the 23rd of March. But the letter from the prisons department informing the family of the execution was dated the 10th of March. So according to Guna's sister, Jodi, the family received a knock on their door at 11 a.m. on the 23rd of March. And so the prison officials had come to say, here's the letter, and your son and your brother is going to be hung on Friday morning. So this was a Wednesday, yeah, on the 23rd. So the family went into, were completely shocked and didn't realize this was happening. They didn't even know that the appeal for clemency had been rejected a few months before that. So we are questioning, you know, the process of it all. And why we call it a secretive hanging is because there is no information, there is no disclosure to the public when an execution is supposed to take place. In some countries where the death penalty is used, there is such disclosure. That includes certain states in the US.
Why is it... So once that letter comes to your door, mm-hmm, and you receive that, what avenues are there left for you? Is nothing left? Is it really truly just a notification and that's all it is?
Okay, I'm not a legal expert, but from my understanding, lawyers can still file a last-minute appeal, similar to what we saw in the Koh Jabing situation, where a last-minute appeal was filed and the execution was stopped. And that is an avenue that's also available here. Yeah, but if the lawyers themselves don't know that their client is going to be executed, that makes it a little bit difficult.
Why do you think there continues to be an air of secrecy surrounding the use of the death penalty in our country?
That is a very good question. I can only assume, but I do think that it's because the authorities know that the death penalty is not the be-all and end-all of crime prevention. But I hope they will tell us why.
Attorney General Apandi Ali said last November that he would propose to the Cabinet that the penalty be scrapped. Minister Nancy Shukri also said that she hoped to amend the Penal Code to abolish the death sentence. Now, these are promising statements, but has the motion been put to Parliament as far as you know?
Nope, it has not. And Amnesty was quite encouraged by the fact that these proposals came out from the AG and the de facto law minister. We waited with bated breath until the 30th of March and, you know, the first few days of April before the Parliament seating ended. But there, as far as we know, no. The proposal to scrap the mandatory death penalty has not gone forward into Parliament.
And in your view, is public opinion a stumbling block for the abolition of the death penalty?
I don't think so. The death penalty is a very emotional subject.
Extremely, yeah.
Yeah. But what we need to also understand why we get emotional because of the death penalty, yeah? Is it because, you know, you see a heinous crime being committed and Amnesty does not say that, you know, there are heinous crimes that are being committed? There are, you know, but where we look at it is the death penalty an answer, yeah? So terrible crimes do happen, and then when terrible crimes do happen, people get, you know, emotional or outraged, and rightly so, right? Because terrible things do happen. The question is, throughout the processes of where a death penalty case is in court, throughout the processes from investigation to the court procedures, are all of these without fault, is the question. Because the chances of there, you know, a mistake happening is too high. You know, I'll give a very, very good example, a very simple example. Can we put that much faith in the criminal justice system when it comes to deciding on someone's life, when we know that if you want to get yourself out of a traffic offense, it's popular knowledge, you can get yourself out of a traffic offense by offering a bribe, right? When it comes to somebody's life, are we completely sure that it's corruption-free? Is the question.
That being said, you know, and as we wait for these things to make their slow way through Parliament and hopefully then into an act or into the abolition of the penalty, should the government put a moratorium on all executions in place as a first step towards a full abolition of the death penalty?
Definitely. So definitely. While the government is studying, I assume they're still studying it because it hasn't gone into Parliament yet. So while this is the mandatory death penalty is being looked at, the use of the death penalty should be stopped. We were talking about public opinion earlier, right? There was a study by the Death Penalty Project a couple of years ago polling public opinion. The study looked at 1,500 Malaysians on the use of the mandatory death penalty for murder, drug trafficking, and certain firearm offences. So this 1,500 people, from this poll, they found that the support for the mandatory death penalty was high when the mitigating factors were unknown. But when you, and that was about high, meaning about 90%. And then when you introduce the mitigating factors, support for the mandatory death penalty just fell. And it was about 24% to about 30-ish percent, you know. And that's the thing, that's where the accused persons are robbed of the when it comes to the use of the mandatory death penalty, because the mitigating factors don't matter. And that shouldn't be the case.
What are some examples of the mitigating factors that would cause people to think, you know, to rethink their position?
In the case of a drug trafficker, right, I'll tell you about this young man whose case that we're working on now. His name is Sharul Izani Suparman. And Sharul Izani was 18 years and 6 months when he was arrested for drug trafficking, right, a drug-related offense. He was arrested, and because Malaysia carries the mandatory death penalty, he was sentenced to death. He's been in prison for the last 13 years. Okay, very straightforward case, right? You have a certain amount of drugs, 622 grams of cannabis, you get the death penalty, the end. But no, these are the mitigating factors that caused us to actually work on the case. Because Sharul Izani was riding a bike he borrowed from his neighbor. And the bike didn't have, had a broken light, and it didn't have a road tax. So when he came across a roadblock, he got scared and he cabut, he ran. Right? The police gave chase, caught him, and they found two brick-like items that were wrapped, each wrapped in newspaper, inside a red plastic bag. On top of the red plastic bag, there was a jacket. Okay? Sharul Izani had borrowed the bike from his friend just before the rope. He came across the roadblock, right? He didn't know that these drugs were in there. He didn't even know what it was. Broken light, he couldn't quite see. So what happened was subsequently, you know, through the court processes and stuff, 18 years and 6 months, you know, you get sentenced to death a few years after. He failed all his appeal processes. And it seemed like a straightforward case, right? But it's not. And a lot of the drug cases are like that, you know. So that's one of the cases that we are working on where the mitigating factors speak for themselves.
In January 2015, Indonesia started executing people in part to address what President Joko Widodo called a national emergency on drug trafficking. And I think that's kind of part of that atmosphere that would result in the case that you were talking about being viewed with such seriousness, such weight. President Joko famously refused to grant clemency and allowed the execution of 8 drug convicts, including 7 foreigners. What are your thoughts on this?
If the execution of the 8 was so impactful, what is Indonesia's current situation on drugs? Have there been lesser drugs entering the country? I don't know. We don't know. You know, there was a lot of international outcry. Amnesty International also made a lot of noise around the executions that happened. Unfortunately, you know, even though governments and NGOs had raised the issue, the execution still went on. And as far as I'm concerned, lives were lost, but drugs are still there.
Who has the power to commute a death sentence if the accused has shown remorse and have been rehabilitated?
In Malaysia, it would be the Sultan or the Agong. The Sultan of a particular state or the Agong would have final say.
And how does it even get to His Majesty's ears? I mean, what is the process by which you tell the king, you know, help?
There's a couple of ways to do it. Usually it's lawyers. The client, death row inmates' lawyers would put forward a petition to the Sultan or to the Agong. So that's one way of doing it. And then that's backed up by different types of documentation like character assessment by, you know, teachers and parents and ketua kampung and all that lah.
Are you personally hopeful that the death penalty will be scrapped in Malaysia?
Yes. The hope is so big, I can't even describe it. But yes, we definitely hope that the death penalty will be abolished in Malaysia. The AG and Nancy Shukri talked about wanting to scrap the mandatory death penalty, but we're saying scrapping the mandatory death penalty is is not the answer. Malaysia should really consider abolishing the death penalty as a whole, and then really look at ways to... It's the more difficult part of the argument, crime prevention and crime reduction. So really look at ways to tackle that instead of, you know, using people as a convenient excuse.
Have there been cases where one's innocence was proven after his or her execution? You know, do any examples kind of jump to mind?
There was the case of... It was a non-Malaysian case. There was a case of Iwao Hakamada, a Japanese man who was on death row for 40 years. And he had always maintained that he could not remember killing his wife. And then 40 years later, the court found out that he was innocent, and then they released him. He's in his 80s now. Do you know? Half his life.
That's a long time.
It's a long time. There's also a very interesting case in the U.S. By the name of... The man's name is Brian Pixoto. He has been on death row for over 20 years for killing his girlfriend's four-year-old son. What happened with that case? I just came across this case a few days ago, but what was interesting there is that he was found guilty because of a medical examiner's report that dated a bruise, that looked at bruising on the boy, on the toddler, and found Pixoto guilty because of that, yeah? And there were other reasons. But what did not come out in court was that the boy had a fall a few days before he died. And there was now, because of progress in the medical field, there is now evidence to say that the boy could have died because of a fall he suffered a few days before that. And, you know, looking at bruising on a body is not the best way of determining a crime, whether a crime occurred. So that's also the other thing that we need to look at, you know, whether medical advances can actually provide absolute proof, or medical testimony, sorry, can provide absolute proof that someone is guilty of a crime.
Earlier, you referenced the fact that Amnesty International does not take the position that people who are on death row did not commit heinous crimes. In some cases, it might be wrong place, wrong time. Mm. In other instances, though, you know, these are people who perhaps did murder someone else or did, you know, commit crimes that were, by any measure of public opinion, awful. Have you ever been accused of being a quote-unquote criminal hugger? I mean, how would you respond to such claims?
Well, I have not yet been...
I don't think this is the first time. I wouldn't consider this.
No, but the only reason that I am as passionate to see that the death penalty is abolished, not just in Malaysia, but throughout the world, is because I take time and I study the cases. It's part of my job. So yeah, I do. You know, I look at the cases, I look at what goes in, I talk to subject matter experts, and then you find out that there are so many loopholes and that there are so many things about the crime itself and the evidence that's presented before the court that it just makes it impossible to point the finger and say that this person is 100% guilty. You know, it's very difficult to do that. If that makes me a criminal hugger, then fine. You know, because I believe that every person deserves justice, right? At the end of the day, that's it. It's just justice.
And we've been talking about getting rid of the death penalty, and that is a challenge in and of itself. But yeah, the challenge would continue after because, well, once you get rid of the death penalty, rehabilitation is a long, slow process. Mm-hmm. What are we replacing it with? There's also the issue of cost, because you might be keeping more people in prisons. It's a long, complicated argument. But from Amnesty International's point of view, if we did do away with the death penalty, what should come to the fore? What should it be replaced with?
Life imprisonment, and then depending on the nature of the crime, whether or not to offer parole. And I would leave this to the lawmakers to decide. But where we're coming from is very clear. Death penalty does not do anybody any favors. It does not help anything. Does not solve crimes. And those things that you raised, Trillian, are the difficult questions that need answering. But the people that are entrusted in government are supposed to provide these answers, and NGOs are there to assist with that process.
You spoke a little bit earlier about, you know, countries that have been abolishing the death penalty slowly. Who have been the countries that have done away with it, to start off with?
Last year, and this is recorded in our Death Sentences and Executions 2015 report, we had four countries that abolished the death penalty for all crimes. This was Congo, Fiji, Madagascar, and Suriname. That brings the number of countries that have abolished the death penalty to 102, which is the biggest number. Well, it's more than half the world. Yeah, Malaysia is one of less than 30 that still use the death penalty.
What are the factors that encouraged those countries that you listed to abolish the death penalty? Because, I mean, what learnings can we take from them in terms of why they succeeded in getting rid of it?
Political will was one. Also because of lobbying at the international level, mostly through the UN, and calls by international organizations such as Amnesty. One of the Mongolia, for example, started abolishing looking at abolishing the death penalty from 2011, 2012, and then they introduced a new criminal code in December 2015 that abolishes the death penalty for all crimes. So Mongolia is an example that countries like Malaysia can take, you know, a lesson from. Abolishing the death penalty would be, we acknowledge that it could be a step-by-step process, but what it really needs is seriousness on behalf of the decision makers and the decision makers to make that happen.
Finally, how can the public support your work to abolish the death penalty in Malaysia?
At this point, I would always say support our campaigns that go on. But this is what I would also like to say. Understand the arguments against the death penalty a little bit more as well. And why NGOs like Amnesty International against the death penalty. It's for good reason. You know, if people are interested, they can find out more about Amnesty's work on the death penalty through our website, amnesty.my, where we have campaigns on Sharul Izani and Koja Bing ongoing at the moment. That's one avenue, or just drop us an email.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Trillin.
I've been speaking with Shamini Darshini, Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia, and we've been discussing the importance of doing away or abolishing the death penalty. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.